Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, and welcome to The Shift, the podcast that aims to tell the no-holds-barred truth about being a woman post 40, created and hosted by me, journalist and author Sam Baker. You'd be hard-pushed to think of anyone who has done more for women writers than this week's guest. 25 years ago, Kate Moss was working in publishing when she looked around and realised that everyone on all the award shortlists looked familiar. Pale, male, and stale. The result, the Women's Prize for Fiction, has just celebrated its 25th anniversary and given a much-needed voice to women's writing. She's also a best-selling author of 9 novels and short story collections, including the millions-selling global smash hit Labyrinth.
So many brilliant things have happened. I think feminism has done so much good. And I just feel that we sometimes get trapped in a very negative spiral, that we look about the things that people are not agreeing on and forget that 98% of stuff actually everybody feels the same about.
Join Kate as she talks about her new book, The City of Tears, her other job as a full-time carer, and why caring is a feminist issue, the devaluing of women's work, and why she really can't wait to be 60. Kate, welcome to The Shift.
It's lovely to see you, darling, in your lovely flat. Are you having a brilliant time up there?
Yes, I love it so much.
How lovely. How very lovely. I'm so, so pleased.
Your microphone is fluffing a bit. I had a little phase in the summer where I was able to do them in person, and and it was just so much better because you could just sit and have a cup of tea. And
I know, and all of this Zoomery, and we're all a bit fed up with it. I've moved my polo neck down. I think it might have been that rubbing on the microphone.
Let's talk a bit about The Burning Chambers, because it's the second book of The Burning Chambers, isn't it? The City of Tears, that's out in January.
Yes, yes, it is. And it's been the most extraordinary experience. I've never planned a series of novels before, even though my earlier series that's called the Languedoc Trilogy, they weren't designed as a series of books. It's just how they kind of fell. And we grouped them together because they're all love letters to Carcassonne and that part of France. I had this idea for this huge story. So did years of research before I started writing, knowing that it was going to be 300 years of history, a Romeo and Juliet story between a Protestant family, Huguenots, and a Catholic family, a feud that was going to last from when they all first met in Carcassonne to Toulouse, to Paris, to Amsterdam, to the Canary Islands, finally to South Africa. So in terms of writing that, I've been thinking about it and writing it. It's going to be a 10-year project when I finished. But I've never had such a big gap between finishing writing a book and publishing it. Because with The City of Tears, it should have come out in May 2020. But because of lockdown and the pandemic, we decided to delay until January 2021. And that means that's almost 18 months after I finished writing it. And that's a really odd experience because I'm supposed to be writing the third book, but I feel utterly unable to move forward until The City of Tears is out in the world. I find it really disabling not to have had any conversations with readers about it yet. And that sense of those characters being kind of frozen, if you like, that they are just waiting in the wings for their 5-minute call.
Are you influenced by what readers say?
No, it's not that it influences me in terms of the storytelling or the characters, or that I'm going to give more page space to this person rather than that person. It's more that it almost feels like it jinxes it. The people in the City of Tears, the families that they've met before, Minu Jubert and her husband and their children, the people that are going to go to Paris for 1572 and get caught up in the most notorious engagement of the wars of religion, which is the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, the flight of some of the people who survived to Amsterdam. And then it astounded me as it came out. It is a lost child story. It's not what I was expecting, but that's the story it turned out to be. And it's more that writing on when that part of their story still isn't out in the world, it feels like bad luck in a weird way. Mm. It feels like I need them to be those selves, you know, rather than anything else. So, you know, I'm glad we're publishing in January. That's all I have to say, because the new one's due in August.
Oh my God.
huge
as well.
They are huge. I mean, but the thing is, it's really, really weird. I mean, I've got one behind me. Yeah, so this is The Burning Chambers, and The City of Tears, which obviously I don't have finished copies yet, is about the same. You've probably got a proof knocking about
I
there.
Have.
Mine's bigger than yours.
Yeah, 540, this one.
Yeah, well, there you are. You see, the thing is, though, when I write, I'm a sprinter, which seems a ridiculous thing to say for mighty great tomes that can hold the door open. But I do all of my writing in my head when I'm walking around the Sussex Downs and in the old days at Carcassonne and Amsterdam. So it's not that I've done it all before I sit down, but in a way, I've kind of written it in my head before I ever come to the computer. So the writing is like a sprint at the end of the process. It isn't in the middle of the process, if that makes sense. So once I sit down, I'll write 8 hours a day, 7 days a week until I have a first draft. And then I'll draw breath, and then I'll start to sort the structure out, and then I will kind of do a third draft, which will be the book it's supposed to have been. But the writing process for me is very, very intense. Whereas I have lots of friends, and you will have lots of friends the same, Sam, who do a, you know, 9-to-5 working day and don't work at the weekends. You know, their writing is like a job, whereas mine is like an essay crisis every time.
Yeah.
No matter how long the book is, it's an essay crisis.
Yeah, I mean, I used to literally have I say 9-to-5 job. It was never 9-to-5. It was more like 7 till 11, 7 days a week. I've really struggled with that institutionalizedness that I had developed over years and years of working in an office. So I'm so undisciplined. You know, I'm married to a writer, and he's like you. He's not a 4 a.m. man, but he will get up and do what he always does and goes off and do it. And I'm a bit like, where's the person who's going to make me
this? Yeah. It's been so interesting, I think, during lockdown and the pandemic and the levels of restrictions people have had, that it's been very interesting for a lot of people that they have realized how much of their creative energy, if you like, comes from other people.
Mm.
And that physical separation between the place that you live and the place that you work. And in the end, it's quite interesting for someone like me. You know, I work here in this space that you can see me in. And it's just off the kitchen, so I can hear Granny Rosie if she needs. And, you know, the dog can go in and out and all of this sort of stuff. I was really becalmed at the beginning of lockdown. I mean, I had a book that I needed to write and I just couldn't get on with it. And it was interesting because it shouldn't have been any different for me, because I spend a lot of my time on my own in this room. But it was somehow because the world was different and the world was quiet outside the door. Mm. But then, of course, it just felt like normal. And I'm very good at, you know, I don't get diverted. I get diverted by the clink of the fridge door opening at 6 o'clock and someone saying, would you like a glass of wine? I'm diverted by that.
Yeah.
But otherwise, in terms of the working, you know, it's this wonderful Picasso comment attributed to Picasso, whether it's true or not. It said that he was asked at the very end of his life by a young artist why, you know, given he was one of the world's leading artists, he still went every day to his studio. And he replied, when inspiration arrives, I want it to find me working.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's how it is for me. I sit here. And some days are better than other days, but I sit here because You want to be at your desk when the moment of like, oh my God, if she does that and he does this, then actually the whole of the middle of the section of the novel suddenly works. You know, the thing that you haven't been able to unknot like a cat's cradle, and suddenly it just like, pow, you've got it. You've got to be here at your desk to do it, you know. So
it's because you start writing at 4 a.m. Is that how that developed?
Yeah. You know, in my day, I'm older than you, and my day would have been described as a square. I was always, you know, the sort of girl that went to bed early, got up early. I was never wild in that sort of way. I go to bed when it's dark and get up when it's light.
It's a good job you don't live in Scotland. That's all I can
No, I'd never be up, never do any work at all. But at the moment, I do go to bed at 8:30. You know, and I've always believed that thing that my ma was used to say, you know, 2 hours before midnight is worth one after midnight. You know, I've never been very good at staying up late. And I just am better at that liminal time of the very early morning between the night and the day, and that I'm most creative then. That sort of sense that when you wake up and you're in a slight, not a dream world quite, but the house is dark, the house is sleeping. Always had a very busy house with a lot of people and a lot of family and caring responsibilities. And so starting at 4 a.m, I never set an alarm, I get up when I wake, is a way of having sometimes 4 hours of silence and work before anybody else gets up or needs anything. And that has been the lifesaver for me as a writer. And, you know, it's not about having little children, actually, because that was way, way back in the past, but it's more about having been a carer. And that sense that the minute the light comes up and the silhouettes of the trees start to come back to life, and you can see the birds in the garden and the first car going by, and then you see that the dishwasher needs emptying and all of this sort of stuff. So it's about not engaging with your real life for as long as possible. Because if I have 4 hours under my belt before the real world comes back, then you can always go back to it. But if you don't get started, you never quite find your stride in the day. You must know this. It's about finding your stride.
Yeah, definitely. So I wanted to talk a bit about being a carer. And you've written a book, haven't you? A Spare Pair of Hands, which is out next summer.
An Extra Pair of Hands.
Extra Pair of Hands. I'd like to talk a bit about that, because I think that's an experience that a lot of listeners will either be having, that either have been a carer, you know, to children or parents, or know is kind of coming for them. So tell us a bit about, it's Greg's mum, isn't it, who lives with you?
Yeah, well, yes. The book is called An Extra Pair of Hands, and it's been published by Wellcome Collection, so the Wellcome Trust and Profile, and it will publish in June 2021 to coincide with Carers Week. And, you know, it's more personal type of book than I normally write, as you know. You know, I love storytelling. I like, you know, by big stories at the City of Tears and Burning Chambers, they're all about strong women charging about, having adventures, you know, historical adventures. And that's my joy, to write those stories and to bring unheard and underheard women's stories to the fore in historical fiction. But my life over the past 10 years has been as a carer. More than 10 years ago now, my wonderful mother and father moved in here as well. They had a sort of separate part of the house. And my father had Parkinson's. So I supported my mother caring for my father. And he died in 2011. And then I was around for my mother, who was amazing and wonderful. And she didn't need care in that same sort of way, but she did need company. And having been widowed after 60 years of marriage and had a few health problems, but she entirely looked after herself and had that extraordinary experience that she was quite literally here one day. And then on the shortest day of the year, 21st of December, 2014, she was gone. And that was a devastating loss. It was so different from the grief and the loss of my father, who was preparing to die for a long time and had a very strong faith, which meant that we were ready for him to go and he was ready to go. And then Granny Rosie, Greg's mother, my mother-in-law, who's lived with us for 25 years, and it was a brilliant, brilliant granny, you know, the sort of granny that did cartwheels in the garden. And so, you know, the moment we moved home to Sussex, Granny Rosie moved in with us. So, you know, the column of credits is all on her side, frankly. But she is 90 now. And over the last few years, last 4 years in particular, her health has deteriorated. And in the last 18 months, to the degree that she is in a wheelchair. So for the first time, I'm a full-time carer now. So, and some people knew this about me, that actually part of the reason I couldn't do this or that anymore was because I had a different level of responsibilities. And so when I was asked to write it, I thought really long and hard about whether I wanted to. And then I thought, well, you know, actually, you know, care is a feminist issue, really. There are lots of wonderful men who are caring as well. But within the paid care sector and very much in the unpaid care sector, by the age of 59, a woman has a 50-50 chance of being an unpaid carer. 8.8 million of us are unpaid carers. And without us, the whole of the health system collapses. Truthfully. And it's only getting more and more acute, partly because there are a lot of people who have not had children and most of the caring is done by children. And the other part of it is something that we should be thrilled about, which is many, many people are living really fantastic, much older lives. But with that has come an increase in the number of people being diagnosed with dementia or Alzheimer's and needing care in a way that it wasn't quite so significant, say, even 20 years ago, because people didn't live as long. And I've spent a lot of my life with older people, and I feel that the language around aging and older people needs to change. I think we should be celebrating age, not seeing it as a problem. And I'm in a very privileged position in that I'm a writer, so I work at home. I'm in a position to be able to care. I love my mother-in-law very deeply. I loved my parents very deeply and was parented myself really well. So for me, it's been a giving back to people who have cared for me. Many people who are carers are caring for people for whom they don't necessarily have a great affection or who were not good parents or in-laws to them. There are many people who are caring on their own. A lot of older women and older men are caring for a spouse and are lonely. So it is an enormous issue. And I realized that I felt really strongly about it because I feel it's a very defining part of who I am, being a carer, actually. And so it's been such a different type of book to write. You know, I'm not someone who really writes personal in that same sort of way, but I'm nearly 60 now. And I suddenly thought, God, you know, with all of my career as a novelist, actually these last now 11, 12 years, they have been very defining about my career as well. And actually, I suppose in the end, the story, An Extra Pair of Hands, you know, the book, it's a tribute. It's a tribute to my dad and to my mum and now to Granny Rosie. And I really hope that it will strike a chord with a lot of people because one in six of us, so just imagine everybody listening today, will be in the position that I'm in, either is already or will find themselves in that position at some moment. So it's a huge number of people. And it's not talked about very much, exactly as you did, dear Sam, with the shift in the menopause and saying, look, it happens to all of us at some moment. Why are we not talking about it? I feel the same about care, that it's something that we should all be talking about. And because of the nature of the people in government, the way that women's voices are often sidelined, and because it is often seen as a women's issue, even though there's been a report that's been knocking about for a long time now about what needs to happen in care, it has never been activated because it's not a priority for the people making the decisions. And that's why I said care is a feminist issue, because if there are not women in the room, it's not exclusively women who care, but the burden of care falls predominantly on women.
And it's that classic thing, isn't it, that women's work, that's me doing inverted commas in the air, has no value at all. And this is just regarded as an extension of it.
Yeah, the carer's allowance, which is really essential for many people who are caring, it's paltry. I mean, it's offensively low. And many women in particular have to give up work to care for somebody full time. So I've been so lucky that I have never had to care for somebody with dementia or Alzheimer's. But that is such an enormous thing for people, because it's possible you'd be caring for somebody for a very long time if physically their health is good. And many women have to give up work in order to care full time for somebody who needs 24-hour care. And then when that person has died, they have no prospect of getting back, or very little prospect of getting back into the job market, and often lose the financial support that was helping them to do that role. So as you say, it's women's work not just being undervalued in emotional terms or in terms of value, but financially. It's very, very tough for a lot of people. So this is why it's important that we all talk about it and all decide what we as a nation want to do about caring for our brilliant older people.
I mean, the thing is, it's not like you don't have like a full-time job just because it's at home. you know, writing, but also the Women's Prize, which we'll talk about in a minute, which has consumed a huge amount of your time. You know, you have been doing this as well as a full-time job.
Well, yes, yes, indeed, indeed. But you see, again, you know, I have a husband. You know, when my parents were here, Granny Rosie, this is why we called the book, and it's Granny Rosie's title, An Extra Pair of Hands, because for all of us, the word carer feels a little bit uncomfortable because it sounds transactional. It takes away the essential thing for all of us, which is love. It doesn't mean it's not often very tough or very upsetting or exhausting, and the repetition of being a carer, everybody who is in that position will know, you know, the same conversations, the medication, the hospitals, all of these things that punctuate a life. For someone like me, it is much easier being a writer and with the Women's Prize and the things that I do, because in the end, I can usually say, I'm really sorry, something's happened. I'm not going to be able to be there, but I'll be there in 3 hours' time instead, or I'll be at the end of the phone. For somebody who has a structured job, who's a teacher or a nurse or a doctor or work in a shop or whatever it is, that is really, really difficult, because all carers talk about how painful it is to become someone who's seen as unreliable, and most carers become unreliable. So I've been able to do my full-time job around being a carer. But when I look back, there are books not finished, books not written, things that I would have loved to have done, which just I couldn't do. But they are very small on the scale of things, because being a writer does give you enormous flexibility in your time in a way that I hadn't realised how valuable that would become. So I've, of course, been writing, you know, The City of Tears all of last year, and then An Extra Pair of Hands this year. So essentially, I've been able to do my full-time job whilst doing my caring job. And, you know, in a way, it's been that one of the things being so good about writing An Extra Pair of Hands is that it's made me really grateful, actually, that I have been able to keep going. I haven't had to duck out, which a lot of people do have to.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
And how does it work with you and Greg? Do you share the caring? Is it the bulk of it you? How does that work?
Greg and I met at school.
Oh, really?
When we were 15. And that has made an enormous difference, because, of course, therefore, he first met my parents, you know, when he was never a spotty youth, obviously. And I, you know, we've known each other and our families. We live a few miles from where he grew up, a few miles from where I grew up. My sister's around the corner, his brother's around the corner. We are, you know, the apples haven't fallen very far from the tree, even though Greg and I both went off, him to Paris and me to university in the UK, and then we've come back to Sussex. This does make a huge amount of difference, because, of course, it's not somebody you don't know coming into the household. So we've had a multi-generational household, as I said, with Granny Rosie for 25 years. So we've always had three generations here. We've only got two now because my children are grown-ups. You know, they're 30 and 28, and they come and go all the time, but they no longer live here full-time. But both my sisters are close by, and my sister is a granny. And so it means that there are lots of people about. That makes an enormous amount of difference. You know, we have a very old-fashioned family village structure in that point of view. With Rosie, a 90-year-old woman doesn't want her son in a bathroom with her, and nor should she have to, you know. So it's those sorts of things. It's that Greg's always been the cook in the household. He was at home with the children when they were young, not me. I was working. So we've always just, you know, juggled things between us. Greg used to be a teacher, so I'd take children to school, he'd bring them home, you know, all of these things. So we've always had a household where whoever is there does the thing that needs to be done. But with care, a lot of it is about intimacy, and a lot of it for older people is about dignity. And so I do those things because it's appropriate. It's more about being girls together, actually, as she'd put it. And we sit at the end of the kitchen table every evening, and she has her G&T and I have my glass of wine, and we natter. And she talks about her childhood in the 1930s and asks me where I was on VE Day. And I point out that I'm not her contemporary. No. But we're pals, and we're very, very lucky. We've always been pals. I mean, it's often sad for all sorts of obvious reasons. You know, sometimes it's not so great, and Rosie doesn't feel she's going to see another Christmas or whatever. And I will be in despair when that happens. But at the same time, we manage mostly to have a pretty lovely time together.
It's really nice. It's really nice. The feminism that you describe informing an extra pair of hands has obviously informed your entire career, hasn't it? Because it's,
yes.
You know, I mean, the Women's Prize has just celebrated, spent a year celebrating 25 years. And that's down to you, Kate Moss.
Well, lots of people. But
in the first instance.
Well, in the first instance, yes. And, you know, we did an event to celebrate the winner of winners, which we did a year of reading women, where we looked back at all the 25 winners, the most recent, of course, being Maggie O'Farrell, her beautiful novel, Hamnet. And the public vote, there were 45 million people engaged with the Reading Women campaign throughout the world. And many, 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 many thousands voted. And the runaway winner, indeed, was Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's Half of a Yellow Sun. And we did an event last night, me in Sussex and Chimamanda in Lagos. And she's mind-boggling, really, isn't it? And she said something really lovely. She said, but the thing is, it's about if you see something that needs changing or needs challenging, you know, you have two choices. And this is what I feel about it all, that you either moan about it or you go and do something. And so the thing about the Women's Prize was we could see that there was not a problem with women being published, although it was a very narrow band of women being published, you know, white middle-class women for the most part being published, women of colour, black women, working-class writers, their voices were not being celebrated in the same sort of way at all. But there was a problem clearly in honouring the work of women. So books were out there, but you know, fewer than 9% of books ever shortlisted for any major literary prize were authored by women, even though some 60% of novels published were by women. So there was a clear disconnect between the valuing of women's writing. This was the issue. And so the choice was very straightforward. Either you go and storm the barricades, or you say, do you know what? We're not going to go and do that. We're going to set up something different and try and do it differently. And it is a wonder this year for me to be celebrating 25 years, to look at the millions of people that have engaged with the prize. And the fact that when I first was talking about it, people would say, if women were any good, they'd win the real prizes.
Oh.
Women, you'll make, you know, all of this. Women are second class. You're making women second class by putting them in a ghetto. And you go, okay, that I totally respect that point of view. But what do you think should be done? Well, if, you know, and then it's, you know, this is sexist. That's the other thing.
Mm.
And of course, your choice, as you know, Sam, is you just have to think, do I think I'm doing the right thing? Do we think we're doing the right thing? Setting up a prize that every year will honour and champion and amplify the very best writing by women in fiction writing. And if the answer to that is yes, then you just have to shut your ears to the criticism and the nonsense and get on with it. God knows what it would have been like in the days of social media, because it was bad enough anyway. You know, I remember I had two young children and I was rung up at home by journalists. And when I would say, I can't speak at the moment, that, you know, it would appear in the paper the next day, Moss refuses to speak. You know, I mean, it was pretty unpleasant in the early days. But now, you know, I have so much admiration for women, younger women in particular, who just put up with this barrage of real vile misogyny on social media. And I'm a bit older now, so I have, you know, sometimes look at my phone, but not so much, you know. But it is a wonderful thing to feel that in the end, I'm an optimist, and I believe that most women want to stand up and shout in support of other women. And the incredible women that have been judges over the years, you included.
Honestly, I loved it. I loved every minute of it.
You know, so many women, and of course men, but so many women have given their time to the prize. And I look at that, I look at the library of books, and the aim was always to put the classics of tomorrow in the hands of readers today, and to just have judges who were exceptional, so that people would see the judging panels and think, well, if Sam Baker likes that, or Tessa Ross likes this, or, you know, Paula Hawkins likes that, then I'll give it a go. And that was always our aim as well, to choose passionate, wonderfully achieving women in whatever field it was. Because in the end, that's why we all like a book. If someone you admire or like says, if you read this, you think, oh, I'll go and buy that. I'll go and borrow that. Yeah. I'll go and, you know, lend it.
And that's definitely been what's happened with Hamnet, hasn't it? That people, you know, have picked it up because other people have said that they liked it. And now it's won the Women's Prize and the Waterstones Book of the Year. And
it never isn't joyous. Every year I think, oh, another year. And then when you listen to readers saying, I mean, I feel this for my own fiction as well, obviously, when people say, well, I'd never read any of your books, but somebody, my mum said, try this. And I've just read it and I loved it. And have you written any others? It's like, you know, it takes me back to my very first independent reading. I think this is true. When we were in a very cold, wet family holiday in Devon in the 1970s, and I have two younger sisters, they're really close in age, you know, 4 and 5 years younger than me. And it just, as always, rained the entire time. And it was one of those holidays where everything smelt of those paraffin heaters and wet oil skins and all of this. And I found on the bookshelf in this cottage, which of course the book was damp slightly, everything, we were damp for 2 weeks. I pulled it out and it was called The Body in the Library by a writer called Agatha Christie. And I thought, well, I've read everything else, I'll give this a go. And it had an old fashioned telephone, you know, sort of stand telephone. And I loved it. And I did, in all innocence, then look at the front and think, I wonder if she's written anything else. 76 other novels. But it's that, and that's the point of prizes. And indeed, the point of doing book events is to engage with readers because, you know, you're a writer, I'm a writer. I publish books to be read. For me, the book is not quite finished until I passed it on to the reader. The reader completes the book for me, which is, of course, why I'm finding it slightly hard to get on with book three in the series, because The City of Tears, which I'm really proud of, and I think it's a really cracking story. You know, it's not quite completed yet because the readers haven't had it. So the prize is supposed to do that always, just to say, you don't have to love all of these books, but give them a go. And if you don't like that one, move on to another one on the shortlist. You know, it's that.
Do you think the prize has some things to learn from younger women now?
I think we all have things to learn from younger women. I also think we have things to learn from older women. It won't surprise you to know that I've never felt that age was the most relevant thing in what somebody says or does or achieves. I think it's the spirit of heart and the way in which anybody, whoever they are, whatever they look like, whatever age they are, engages with other people in the world outside them. So I feel very strongly, you know, I'm at the top of middle age now, I would say, that what we all ought to be doing is making sure that we listen up to the women that have gone before and down to the women that are coming after us. And the dialogue between generations is something that has been challenged quite a lot recently, more than often. And I think partly that is to do with technology and the fact that there are whole discussions happening that are quite specific to different age groups, platforms that attract particular age groups. And I've always thought, you know, that was the silliest thing about school, that you're supposed to be friends with somebody just because their birthday falls within the same 12 months. You know, that always seemed a bit bonkers. But I do absolutely think we need to listen to younger women. I have a 30-year-old daughter, and I have a 20-year-old and a 17-year-old niece. Indeed, I have a 35-year-old niece. And there are many discussions about feminism, which do feel generational to me. But I always then go and say to my daughter and my nieces, okay, tell me your take on all of this. Because the other consequence, I think, of social media and the ability of anybody to type anything and it be out in the world within a minute, is that sort of integrity of thought and research and checking your facts and actually listening to what was really said rather than Chinese whispers of amplification, you know, all of this is problematic in all sorts of ways. But I think in some of the debates, quite often, if you're my sort of age, you only come into them at the periphery. So I think it's essential to listen to younger women and say, no, that's not what we're saying about this, that, the other, whatever the this, that and the other is. But I do also say when I'm talking to younger feminists and we're having those conversations, you know, learn the names of the women who fought for abortion rights to get the vote. You know, all of these things, it's very easy to forget that other women have gone before us and have fought for the things that we now take for granted. And the next generation will take other things that we've done for granted. You've been very campaigning in many ways, Sam, and you know all about this, about what it means to be a woman in the world of business and all of these things. And I think that is extremely important, that women's history vanishes quite easily. And as feminists and women, whatever age, we owe it to those who've gone before us to not forget and not let their battles be erased because it's become commonplace. You know, and I think it's fantastic that, you know, when I talk to my children about being in an office in the 80s and they would say, well, yeah, but you wouldn't have had any problem. And I went, ah-ha-ha! And the idea that my generation accepted that there would be hassle in the office from men, that it was your responsibility to minimize the opportunities for those things and to deal with it, because the pressure of women aren't really suited office environments was basically, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. So, and then, you know, my daughter once said to me, why didn't you go and complain to the boss? And I said, he was the boss.
Yes.
And that's great that they were like, what? Because everyone of my age took it for granted. And women looked after other women by saying, you know, don't get in the lift with him. It was just, you know, part and parcel of it. So I think so many brilliant things have happened. I think feminism has done so much good. And I just feel that we sometimes get trapped in a very negative spiral, that we look about the things that people are not agreeing on and forget that 98% of stuff actually everybody feels the same about. Feminism, you know, the F word, what else does it mean? Well, it means fairness. And in all of these things. So I'm still pretty optimistic despite this terrible year of 2020. But yeah, we just need to listen. We need to listen.
So you're in your late 50s now. How do you feel the kind of last decade shaped you and shaped your identity, that kind of the shift that we all go through at this point?
Do you know, I remember you and I meeting right before you were starting to write your book, The Shift.
Yeah.
And you're a bit younger than me, so you're just slightly different place in that. I was, you know, out the other side and waving gaily, free of all of those things. But it was had a very profound influence on me talking to you about that. And of course, then reading your book, which I think is amazing, is that there were quite a few things for me that I realized were about being perimenopausal and then menopausal that actually I had attributed to something else. Because my 50s, which coincided with the shift, were about grieving and care. Mm. So I think some of the things that were actually to do with menopause, and it's one of the things in An Extra Pair of Hands I've put in, that many women are coping with becoming a carer at the same moment that actually their bodies and sometimes their minds are going completely haywire. So looking back, some of the things that I felt I'd been very untouched by the menopause, but I think that's because I ascribed a lot of it to grief and therefore, you know, feeling like I was in a bit of a fug and, you know, normally have a very good memory and my memory was really quite poor for a while. I'm a small person and I'm often cold, but I was sometimes hot and cold. And again, I put that down to kind of emotion, really. Mm. So it was reading your book. And I thought, you know, I think a lot of that was actually about the menopause, not really grieving, although I was very bereaved by the death of my father and then the death of my mother. So for me, I would say the 50s have been quite a challenging decade. I'm not going to be sorry to be shot of them, actually. I do age inflation. I've been saying that I'm nearly 60 for some time because my dad died a few months before my 50th birthday. And then my ma died in the middle of all of that. And so I've had a big shift in my working and emotional and home life in my 50s. So I'm looking forward. I'm really thinking out come the flags on my 60th birthday. I think at the moment I look like a tired 59-year-old, but I somehow believe that when I'm 60, people are going to go, oh, you don't look like 60. And of course, although I tell myself I don't care about that, I'm looking forward to saying, oh, no. And yes, I would say in a way, the 50s have probably been my least favourite decade as an adult.
Interesting. On that note, what's your emotional age?
In a way, I feel close to my teenage self in many ways, funnily enough. Now, whether that's about introspection that comes from the pandemic and therefore living a very, very, very domestic and home life in a way that since my 20s, I haven't done. And possibly because of writing An Extra Pair of Hands, I've been looking back on my childhood and my teenage years and my family, and I live in a mile and a half from where I grew up. So there was this extraordinary thing when the first lockdown happened, the real lockdown, when everything was shut. And my husband and I would walk through the centre of Chichester, which is, you know, we live about a mile north of Chichester itself. And it reminded us both very, very strongly of Sundays in the 70s, where you walked through the town. There wasn't anywhere to go. There were a couple of posh restaurants, but they were, you know, grown-ups went there. Young people didn't go to a restaurant on their own without their parents. And they did Sunday lunch and shut at 2:30. And so if you wanted to walk with your boyfriend hand in hand, you walked around the empty city, the empty town. And I think maybe that has meant that emotionally, I feel quite close to that girl at the moment. And also, I suppose, I feel quite close to the person who first had children because my children are now the age I was when I had them. And I remember that very much, that enormous shift that happens when you become a mother. I felt that was a big emotional step change for me. And, you know, my children are 30 and 28, and that was when I was pregnant and having children exactly. So I feel quite close to that person as well. I think one of the joys about living for so long with older people, and, you know, there were many other older people. My godmother only died a couple of years ago. She was an Anglican nun at the age of 104. Both of my grannies nearly hit 100. My auntie died a couple of years ago, just shy of 100. So I think one of the wonderful consequences about spending a lot of time with older people is that I'm often pretty young in the room. You know, I think, you know, in your business, you're such an important editor and journalist and writer, and then all of these things. You were often surrounded by children, virtually, you know, very yeah. young people, whereas my day-to-day life is spent with people much older than me. And I think that's okay, because it kind of keeps you quite young. So
yeah, the reverse of spending a lot of time with 20-somethings makes you feel yeah. completely geriatric.
Exactly, exactly. You know, whereas, you know, I've still got my knees. I can still run.
Now I'm going to ask you the questions I always ask. Give me a book recommendation. What book would you push on a friend?
Of course, the entire Women's Prize for Fiction, 25 winners. But actually, the one I'm going to say is a book called Dancing with the Octopus, which is written by an American woman called Deborah Harding. It's the most extraordinary memoir. It's a story of a 14-year-old girl in the Midwest who was abducted from her church car park when she was 14 and raped and left for dead. And the thing that makes this book so exceptional, I think, is that although it is the real story, the story of a true crime, she is an exceptional writer, I think, beautiful lyrical writer. But also it is a really good call to arms, say, in the end, even when something as awful as the things that have happened to Deborah Harding have happened, there is a way of taking control of your story, however awful that story is. For me, I think it deserves to win all the prizes.
I'm off to buy that then.
Good.
What piece of advice would you give younger women?
Travel hopefully. Travel hopefully. I think that there is, for all sorts of reasons, a lot of the messaging about being a woman and being a girl is quite negative. I think there's quite a lot of, rightly, attention to all the terrible things and the injustices and the lack of equal pay and domestic. But, you know, they're all the things that we as women know and fight against and try to make, you know, a small difference however we can. But I think also what's really important is travel, hopefully. Be yourself. Raise your eyes up to the horizon, not down to the ground.
Wonderful. Tell me your old bird role model.
Old bird role model?
Yes.
Well, like an old woman, not an actual bird.
No, not actually.
Well, yeah, I say that, you see, because I really like birds. And I, at the moment, there's quite a lot of goldfinch activity going on right outside my window. I'm going to go, and this won't surprise you, and it's not the right Bronte for you, I know, but I am actually going to go for Emily Bronte, even though I suspect she was not the greatest of company. I do think that her one novel, Wuthering Heights, I genuinely believed it changed what it was possible for women to write. And I think that that extraordinary ambition of that novel, the refusal to play the Victorian game, that it was appropriate for women to write about these subjects but not those subjects, the incredible sort of raw violence and force of that book, and the fact that she just lived a very difficult and odd and challenging life, but as herself, right up until her death from TB, like, you know, the whole family decimated. She was a woman out of her time in a way. She just lived her life as she was determined to live it, against all expectations and traditions and pressures to be a certain sort of woman. And I think it didn't make her happy, but I think that that is the lesson for us all. Live as ourselves and try to resist being drawn into being looking differently or feeling differently, or women should do this or women shouldn't do that. You know, so follow Emily. Be more Emily Bronte.
Brilliant. What's your superpower?
Talking. No. One Christmas, for some reason, must have all been very bored. Everybody came up with their kind of superpowers with a slight edge to it. And mine was described as relentless optimism or relentless perkiness. And I do remember my daughter once saying to me, when she was waiting for news of something that meant a great deal to her, she said, "Mum, I just want to say this one thing. Tomorrow, if I haven't got what I want from this, please don't tell me the silver lining." So my superpower, which is a positive and a negative, is always trying to see the best in a situation, when sometimes it's all right to be disappointed. Or as Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie said to me yesterday in the interview, she said, you know, sometimes a slice of self-pity is okay.
I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah, yeah.
And lastly, how many fucks do you give?
More than I should, actually. You know, for all of my advice to, you know, be yourself and all of those things, I do all of those things. But I am sometimes disabled by empathy, I would say. I do very much worry about how other people are feeling, and that does kind of play into how many fucks you give. I've never been able to just not worry about what other people think. I'm always kind of alert to, is that person a bit upset or whatever? And that means that sometimes I care too much about what other people think.
Definitely, just human. That's brilliant. Thank you very much, Kate. It's been lovely
to
chat to you.
Such a pleasure. I wish we were together and we could be going off to wherever.
And no hideous technical problems.
No, but we did it in the end.
Thank you for listening. I'd love to hear your feedback. You can reach me on Twitter at Sam Baker and Instagram at The Other Sam Baker, using the hashtag The Shift. You can hear a new episode of The Shift each week on Acast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you hear, please do rate and subscribe, because it really does help other people find us.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.